Hello, and welcome to this podcast miniseries on coastal resilience in the face of climate change. I'm Josephine Anselin. I'm a PhD student at the University of Cambridge, and I'm currently doing a policy internship at the Centre for Science and Policy here in Cambridge. Through this podcast series, I'm hoping to shed some light on coastal resilience, a topic that has been close to my heart ever since witnessing coastal management issues firsthand while living in Jakarta, Indonesia's capital city, which has also been referred to as the world's fastest sinking city. In each episode of the podcast, I'll be talking to a different coastal research expert. And together, we'll explore a specific aspect of the UK's coastal adaptation to climate change. We'll discuss some of the latest science, the links between academic research and policy, as well as steps that academics can take to help bridge the gap between coastal science and policy action. For the last episode of this series, I'm very pleased to be joined by Dr. Zien van der Plank to discuss a recent study which focused on coastal adaptation policy transitions. Dr. Zien van der Plank is a senior research fellow based in the School of Geography and Environmental Science at the University of Southampton. Her research focuses on coastal change and adaptation, with a strong focus on how individuals can be part of the research and policy processes. She has studied contemporary and past coastal changes in the UK, as well as around the world. So without further ado, let's get into this conversation. First of all, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation and to share your expertise. So you're involved in a number of research projects at the interface between coastal science, public engagement, and policy. So what personally motivates you to work within this area of research?
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. And that's a great opener, partly because I'm always asking myself that. I grew up quite far away from a shoreline in a rural community in Australia. So I didn't really visit the coast very often. And yet I've ended up studying almost exclusively changing coastlines, coastal communities, as you say, had engagement of communities, coastal resilience. But when I reflect on it, where I grew up was a small community and it was experiencing very significant changes to its environment, to the types of hazards it was facing and the severity of those hazards. And yeah, even while I was, I guess, growing up there and going to school, what was already really interesting to me was how in small communities where you don't have sort of the economic argument or the population numbers to necessarily build physical infrastructure or have those sorts of physical adaptations to our changing environment, how can you still involve and listen to and capture community voice and basically what people there want from their changing environment, how they want to adapt to it. So I would say what motivates me to work in this area is especially to look at smaller coastal communities and towns and understanding how we can still support their adaptation and resilience, even when they often don't have the economic factor or the population numbers behind them to access things like the Thames Barrier, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for sharing that. So today's discussion is going to focus on a recent paper for which you are a co-author. And this paper is titled Transitions in Modes of Coastal Adaptation, Addressing Blight Engagement and Sustainability. So could you just start by briefly explaining what the main motivation for conducting this study was?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to flag, first of all, that study, that paper came out of a larger research project called Coastal Res. Mm. And that was led by far more senior researchers than myself. I was, in fact, I think still a research assistant at the time and was fortunate enough to be invited to be a part of that research process. And the paper itself is led by Sally Brown. So I just want to sort of highlight that that paper is very much was created under her leadership. And the motivation for that Coastal Res project from which this paper emerged was exploring resilience in coastal management and recognizing that in, say, the late 20th century, we had this shift in coastal management in the UK towards a risk-based management approach, going beyond a defence and structural-based management approach. But that in the last 10 to 20 years, what we're very interested in, first of all, in academia, and it's filtering through very much into national policy and local policy as well now, is resilience, which even goes beyond risk to say that it's that being ready for and adapting to our coastal environments is also about understanding how we can anticipate and recover from the changes that we experience, whether that's erosion or flooding or other changes to our environment. And then the problem or the challenge that this project and this study addresses specifically is that, okay, we're all interested in resilience now, but when we study and try to apply resilience, it's still often in qualitative ways. So we try and capture it qualitatively, and it's often in a way poorly incorporated into policy. It's identified as the goal, but we don't really know the pathway and the steps to achieving that policy goal. So the project as a whole was looking at a method to capture and formalize how we can actually build those pathways towards resilience. And this paper specifically was looking at that in a policy context. So we know that policy transitions are going to need to occur. They're built into our policies already, but how do we actually enable those policy transitions to occur?
So there's one term I wanted to clarify first, just to make sure we're all on the same page. Because in the paper, when discussing the different kind of coastal adaptation options, the paper refers to different shoreline management plans. And so for people who are maybe not familiar with coastal resilience policy, could you just start by briefly explaining what these shoreline management plans are and also the different policy options that are considered within this the scheme?
Another really good question, and especially because shoreline management plans are in a way one of the main planning tools that coastal managers are using, especially to think about current and future shoreline change. And so shoreline management plans link back to what I said about late 20th century transition to risk-based management. So in a way, the first set of shoreline management plans, SMP 1, represented that first shift to recognizing that perhaps defending the coastline, which we call hold the line often, hold the current line of the coastline, is not necessarily going to be the most appropriate approach to managing our shoreline in all locations. And so what the first generation of shoreline management plans and then the second generation built on was this idea that actually not in all locations perhaps should the shoreline stay in its current physical location, like geographically. So what are the other options that might need to be on the table? And so under Shoreline Management 2, which is our current generation of shoreline management plans, there are four policy options that are explored across three different time periods. Mm-hmm. So the three different time periods which the policy looks at are current day, first 10 to 20 years, which are actually expiring kind of now, like that was the 2000s to current day. The next 30 years, a medium term time stamp. So that's kind of happening actually now. And then 50 years and beyond. So a long-term look at what state the shoreline should be in that time. Mm-hmm. And so then what are the four options that we look at for every segment of the coastline around England and Wales. I'll start with hold the line, because that's sort of this classic, what we often consider to be a defense-based approach or option, which just literally says, well, we want to keep the physical shoreline in its current day position. So if in Southampton, the edge of the docks are currently at this particular coordinate, that's where we want them to be at the end of this epoch as well. So if they were there in 2000, we want them to be there now in 2020 in epoch one. But we might say actually in the next epoch, we want it to move further out into the water, perhaps because the docks in Southampton have expansion plans. So actually they want to shift towards advance the line. That's another one of the four management options. And advance the line says we want actually the position of the shoreline to move further into the water, into the sea. The opposite of that is manage realignment, where we're saying actually in this particular coastal context, there are environmental or economic or other reasons why the shoreline should shift inland. It might be, for example, to preserve existing salt marsh that is very important for migrating birds. But there are various reasons why you might choose any of these options. And then the fourth option is what we call no active intervention, which in a way is distinct from the other three because it's not really talking about the position of the shoreline, but about what management choices we make. And as the name implies, it implies that there's no physical intervention, management action taken for that particular part of shoreline. So in short, in brief, as you are, sorry, three time epochs, four policy options are shoreline management plans in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, thank you. That really clarifies things. And so just to make sure I understand it correctly, so the last option you mentioned, the one where there's no action, I forgot what it was called.
No active intervention.
Yeah. No active intervention. So would something like nature-based solutions, would that fall under that?
I think this point our nature-based solutions, I mean, they can fall under any of the options because, again, I think as we're talking about today, what these shoreline management plans are policy choices. How you enact them, that could be physical engineering. It could be, as we're going to talk about later, I think, engaging communities. It could be nature-based solutions. So again, managed realignment could be a shift from a 100-year-old seawall to a salt marsh that is further inland, but also actually absorbs some of the wave impact for the community behind it. So nature-based solutions could fit actually into possibly any of the four options.
Could you just talk a little bit about the methods that were used in the study and how you just went about conducting the study?
Yeah, so just in brief, as I already highlighted, this paper came from the Coastal Res study or project. So it formed part of a larger project that was looking at coastal resilience across England and Wales. And as a part of that, we ran a series of workshops inviting coastal practitioners and policy actors from across the scale, so from local level right through to national, to have really structured focus group discussions around these questions of coastal resilience, around the shoreline management plans and sort of the challenges in delivering a resilience-based coastal management approach. And without getting too much into the detail of the academic analysis process, in essence, we recorded those discussions and did thematic analysis on what key topics were emerging from that. But so really, all the results from this study are a combination of the input of a significant amount of coastal actors from England, together with the most up-to-date contemporary literature on the current status of coastal management in England and Wales.
And so based on the findings from the study, what would you say are the main challenges that are faced when trying to implement a transition in coastal policy?
It's quite easy when doing academic research to identify challenges. Mm-hmm. Not to be flippant, but when you have conversations in a coastal context, there are many challenges that we face in trying to deliver coastal policy and transitions. So, we could talk about challenges all day. I'll try not to. But there were five key challenges that were identified across these workshops and these discussions, and that we can look at literature and policy documents to sort of add extra verification to, right, that it wasn't just the people we're speaking to, but we can see in previous studies that these come up as well. And so we can split these into sort of three key policy drivers or barriers to transitions, and then two social drivers or currently in some way barriers, challenges to these transitions. So I'm not sure how much detail you want me to go into in each one, but for example, one of the policy challenges is around there being different policy-making timeframes. We spoke about the shoreline management plans working from today, which is now actually almost yesterday, right, 2000s to around now, a 30 to 50-year time horizon and a 50 to 100-year time horizon. And that's almost unheard of in spatial planning, which is something else that, especially at the local authority level, needs to be carried out regularly, needs to be forward-looking, but often more on the 5 to 10, maybe 20-year window. So mm-hmm. One of the challenges is how do practitioners and policymakers balance the pressing priorities, real priorities of supporting housing development now, which we need, with you know, 50 to 100 year identified policy transitions where currently is a perfect place to build houses, we actually know in 50 to 100 years is not an appropriate place. So that's one key challenge in implementing a coastal policy transition, is how do we balance today's planning priorities with tomorrow's planning priorities that we need to be thinking about today. And so that links, I guess, very closely actually to the second, sorry, maybe I sort of merged two challenges into one, but a second challenge then is that demand for housing. Like, we know that there is a, let's say, housing crisis today. Like, there are more people needing a physical place to live than we can provide, keep up for providing houses for. So there is this pressing and I believe often legal requirement for local authorities for producing a certain amount of houses per year or per 5 years. And that's, as far as I'm aware, you know, some of those commitments are legally binding. They need to be meeting those targets. Whereas shoreline management plans, for better or for worse, are not legally binding. There is a commitment that they have to be taken into consideration, but it's not that when a shoreline management plan says this is a zone for mandatory realignment, that spatial planners have to say, well, okay, then I can't put houses there. So there's also that, I don't want to say conflict, that's perhaps too strong of a word, but that tension between, again, this need to meet other legal planning commitments, such as housing being one key example, with shoreline management plans needing to be taken into account but not being legally binding. The other key policy barrier that came up was around the funding situation. I think we might talk about that a bit more later, but in essence, as in all areas of, I guess, public funding, it's not guaranteed. Whereas, again, if we're working on very long timelines, then there is sort of this need to know what the funding is going to be like into the future. Like, if it comes in every 2 to 5 years and it changes shape, that's hard to marry with 30 to 100 year plans of what we should be doing. And then from those, from that more social side, what are the social challenges to facilitating transitions in coastal policy? There are, I guess, two, and again, they're quite strongly linked, but they are just, we can distinguish between them. One being around that in these conversations that we had in these workshops, there was a clear recognition that there is a need for stakeholder engagement. Stakeholder engagement meaning the public, but also all affected, influential and interested parties in a coastal space, which are many, as you can imagine. It's the people who live there. It's the people who care about the environment there. It's the people who use it. It's the people who have their livelihoods there, who have industry there. And yet we're still finding that, and this is again sort of from the findings, that I guess in some ways our engagement in these processes isn't perhaps up to scratch, or that policy decisions or plans are made in shoreline management plans. There is a process of engagement in that process of making the shoreline management plan. And yet when it's produced and it's time for a policy transition, say from hold the line to no active intervention or another transition, people are surprised that it's happening. And I'm not saying that that's people's fault, right? But what I am saying is that the results show that there is, you know, there shouldn't be a surprise. If the engagement's been done effectively, everyone should be like, yeah, we're aware this is happening. We may not have agreed to it, but we're conscious of it. So it's concerning that, and it's a challenge that we're finding that when key policy transition moments arise, the reaction of stakeholders at times is that they're not ready for it. They didn't realize it was going to happen. Okay. And that links to the final challenge that we identified, which is, and this is perhaps especially so for the public, but other stakeholders too, is that from these workshops, it emerged that there is a disconnect between people and long-term coastal processes. Now, again, part of this could stem from a recent history in England, last 100 years, of being really good at defending our coastline. So people no longer regularly experience these extreme events that we referred to previously. It's unusual to experience extreme coastal flooding. We might see nuisance flooding. Again, just a local example, there's a road down at Leek near Southampton, which if it's a very stormy day, you can probably go and stand there. I don't recommend this, but you can probably go and stand there and see the waves overtopping the road. So we see a lot of instances of nuisance flooding, but we've done a very good job of defending the shoreline. So for the last living memory of the public and other stakeholders, we don't see shoreline movement anymore. We don't see the shoreline being breached, the coastal defences being breached, which means that we've lost that understanding that the shoreline is a dynamic place. So a really interconnected but gritty combination of challenges to enabling these policy transitions in the shoreline management plans from taking place.
So you mentioned funding as one of the challenges. So what are the funding options that are currently available in the UK to fund coastal policy transitions?
Yeah, I did mention funding and I said I might go into more detail, so I better do that. But that said, I would say of the different options I mentioned, I would recommend that if you're listening to this, you go and look them up for the precise details, because they do change year on year and my knowledge of it might be slightly outdated. So the main funding options available in the UK to fund coastal policy transitions at the moment are, I would say there are two. One is private funding. So that could be, that's basically saying the landowner of that section of shore can pay for their own coastal policy transition. There are obviously regulations and policies in place as to what you're allowed to do with your shoreline, but if you have approval to do it, you could fund it yourself. And I think I spoke earlier about Southampton Port, so it could be that Southampton Port decides it wants to advance the line, and it could, if it had all the consents and permissions to do that, it would be completely free to 100% fund that policy transition itself. But as you can imagine, changing our shorelines is a very expensive process. I mean, partly because, to begin with, because of all the approval processes you need to go through to be able to do it, which are reasonable. It's, you know, environmental impact assessments, community engagement, and so forth. I mean, even just exploring the impacts of how you changing the coastline would impact other parts of the coastline. So it's expensive. So the other, or perhaps the most dominant route, is what we call partnership funding. And partnership funding comes from central government. I think it comes through DEFRA and then through the EA. I think the EA manages that funding. And in essence, is a grant and aid scheme that assesses the costs versus the benefits of your project against a set of outcome measures. And all this information is available on the government web pages as to what those outcome measures are, even how you calculate what your outcome score would be. But what the partnership funding in essence does is says, from our assessment, from our tool that we have to calculate the benefits of this policy transition or scheme versus the costs of it, this is the amount that we believe is reasonable to be publicly funded. And that could be 100%. It could be that it goes into the calculator and says, this transition from hold the line to mandatory alignment is very good value for money, so we'll fund all of it. But more often than not, it's a lower score than that. So it might be 90%, 80%, 40%, in which case, again, you as the one wanting to facilitate a policy transition or a certain change in the coastal environment will need to source that funding elsewhere, whether that is from local authorities, whether that is from other private or public partners, that funding has to come from elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But then that said, I'm saying that these are how we can fund coastal policy transitions, but really in a way what I'm saying is this is how we can fund hold the line. So I think we might get into this a little bit later, and the paper certainly looks at it, that the funding system, the current funding system, is very well set up to support hold the line places where the current policy is hold the line. It struggles with locations where actually the policy or policy transition is something like mandatory alignment or no active intervention. It's much harder to put that information into the funding calculator and come out with a score that says, oh, this is good value for money. We'll support your community engagement to manage your no active intervention. Mm. So just sort of tangentially, at the moment, there is also the ongoing Flood and Coastal Resilience Innovation Program, which again, you can find more information online or on government web pages. But these are 25 projects. They're not all coastal. Some are inland flooding as well, but some are coastal erosion, some are coastal flooding, which are looking at how can we have more innovative approaches to managing our coasts, flooding and erosion in a changing climate. So they're perhaps an area where some of the flood and coastal resilience innovation program projects are looking at specifically coastal policy transitions and how can we support them. So there's a, but that funding is specifically for those projects. So it's not something that a local council could bid for and currently get funding from.
Yeah. Okay. And so now you've spoken about the different challenges that were identified. So which solutions did the study identify to better support these coastal adaptation policy transitions?
Yeah, so this is where my slightly flippant remark earlier comes back to bite me, where I said it's, you know, in research, it's really easy to identify the challenges, especially around, say, coastal management or coastal adaptation. The trickier thing is always to think about, okay, so what are the solutions? How do we overcome the current situation that we're in and the challenges that we've spoken about? But again, being slightly proud about the work that was led by Sally Brown, I think there's a really good figure in the paper, if you're able to access the paper, figure 4, which really nicely encapsulates what we suggest as some of the solutions to the challenges we've spoken about. And so we identify 3 key solutions. And we've titled these in the paper, Integrated Multiscalar Preparedness for Coastal Change, Accessible Evidence-Based and Future Vision to Nurture Political Confidence in Adaptation, and Defined, Time-Bound and Accessible Diverse Funding Streams. So quite chunky solutions. But let's just break those down into their parts. So this integrated multi-scalar preparedness for coastal change is sort of getting into that point earlier that at the moment, if we're not looking at defense-based options, if we're thinking about resilience as opposed to risk, so we're thinking about preparedness to respond to and recover from these changes, then clearly one thing we need to be building towards is that preparedness. How can we, as actors in this space, have greater preparedness for those transitions that are required? And this is something, again, that came out of the workshops, that preparedness for those transitions, focus on preparedness, so being prepared now for what comes later, is something that we need, that came out of those workshops. What is less clearly articulated is what does that preparedness look like? So if we're saying that we're not fully prepared now, that, you know, it's multiple challenges, what is it that needs to change for us to be prepared? And again, both in the literature and in the workshops, it was hard to articulate what that is. But some examples could include more effective public engagement. So we do engagement. I don't know why I say we. I don't make shoreline management plans. But when shoreline management plans are prepared, there is a process of engaging stakeholders, including the public, in them. But as I spoke about earlier, people are still often surprised when those shoreline management plans are put into action, there's a policy transition, and it's not what was expected. So we need to improve our public engagement. And some of the reasons we might need to do that include, no surprise, greater transparency. So that, you know, there does seem to be that we're saying we're doing it and yet people are surprised. Well, then something is being hidden in a way. Like there's something in the process that is not clear. So we need to make that clearer. And maybe it's also, or again, not maybe, as in the people we spoke to also flagged that part of this might be that the information that is available, like it is available. A lot of these documents are available in public spaces. But are they accessible? Can my partner's mother, who's more local, could she go and read it and really understand what it means for her local shoreline? Not just today, but in the future. And could she understand at which point she could engage in it? And then linked to that is that conversation earlier that we had around that loss of knowledge or connection between us and long-term coastal processes, which we can, again, solve or resolve or mitigate or begin to address through teaching and learning and sharing. And again, this is around preparedness, right? It's not learning isn't, if we're learning now for something now, we're doing it too late. So we need to be facilitating learning now for that future policy transition. Yes, so that's sort of, that was addressing solution 1. Integrated multi-scalar preparedness for coastal change. And the second, I think we're already getting close, you know, we're already leading to with that accessible evidence base, a future vision to nurture political confidence and adaptation. Which again, goes in a few directions. What's the solution look like? There's the word political in it. So one of the challenges that we face is that no politician is going to have in its political pamphlet, I'm standing for this location and I'm standing for us losing 20 houses in the next 20 years. This is why you should vote me in. It's, you know, it's a really contentious issue. So how do we generate a political narrative where it, okay, maybe you still don't put it in your political brochure, but you can have that discussion. You can at least acknowledge that this is one of the options that might need to be explored. So something that we explore in the paper a bit is, you know, is one way to address this that we have cross-party consensus on what the policy transitions are. That it, we always take the politics out of it by saying, well, regardless of your political party, everybody agrees that this is the appropriate future for this coastal area. But then some of the tensions with that is that that's not particularly democratic to say, actually, we're taking coastal management completely out of the democratic sphere. We're saying it's beyond political discussion. It's a completely technocratic process. So pros and cons to how we might explore that solution. But the other more practical side to this second solution, and again, I think we touched on this very early, is that we now do have resilience embedded in a lot of policy from the national scale right down to quite local for coastal change. But the challenge that was identified, the challenge that was identified in the workshops was that, how do we do it? Like we now know that that's what we want to move toward, but what pathways are there to actually facilitate that? And I know that that sounds like a challenge again, but I think we can see it as a solution if we recognize that the next plan or policy or tool that is needed to facilitate policy transitions are a toolkit to enable them. So, you know, what funding mechanisms are we going to have in place that don't only preference defense-based policies, but also recognize and can have outcome measures for non-hold-the-line coastal options, for example? Or how can we create local spaces where we can start having these conversations about the change that is going to happen in 50 years? We can start those processes now. So the second accessible evidence base and future vision is about, I guess, making, generating that discourse, enabling, facilitating that discourse for policy transitions that are happening maybe in 20 years, but recognizing that a transition is not a sudden movement. So it's something that we need to be starting on now. And again, that feeds really nicely into the third solution, which is around those diverse funding streams. So recognizing that, I think as we touched on when you asked me earlier, actually there are a limited number of ways to get coastal management, coastal transitions, coastal change funded at the moment. There are really in essence two options. You go private or you go partnership funding. And if you don't have the private funding, if you can't get access to the partnership funding because you don't meet the outcome measures, okay, well, you've still got the private funding. But if, again, like talking about my motivation to do this work, if you're a small coastal community who doesn't have a large industry that happens to be based in your coastal town, then you probably don't have access to the kind of private finance that you need. So this third solution is saying we need to explore how the different places where funding might be able to come from, and that it shouldn't just be either you're a rich landowner, such as a large industry, or you meet partnership funding. And the paper explores a few options, which could be insurance, being more creative with our insurance schemes that currently exist and working with insurers as a coastal management industry, I guess, or coastal management system, working with insurers more closely. It can also be recognizing that maybe funding needs to come from various scales, not just national level top down, but also recognizing that if we're talking about transitioning from, I guess, defense-based thinking to other ways of managing our coastlines, that with that come the possibility for different funding streams. So in essence, three solutions that in themselves are still quite challenging to deliver, but they do identify key actions that we could be taking now to enable those policy transitions.
Yeah. Well, thank you for this great overview. And then I also wanted to ask you more generally, if you have any kind of practical advice for coastal researchers who are maybe interested in using their research to help inform policy. So just based on kind of your experience, I don't know if you have any advice.
I can think of some advice, yeah. I mean, I don't know personally how effective I've been yet in informing policy, but certainly through being part of projects like this, I've been exposed to the process of it. And I guess from a research point of view, I would say work with your practitioners or your stakeholders of interest. So, the challenges and the solutions, so the challenges and then the policy solutions that we've identified through this paper and that hopefully are now getting pushed forward towards policy, they were generated through working in these workshops with the practitioners and stakeholders for whom this is of interest. And that also means hopefully that that stops the research from being static. This will, by having worked with the community of interest, we have a movement to try and facilitate this to become policy. So that's one, and very much linked to that, I would say, if you're looking to help inform policy in your research, identify that and build that in from the start of your research project. So I'm not saying let your research findings be influenced by the policy conclusion you want. What I am saying is, if that's one of your aims, then ensure that the research questions you ask are going to answer the policy question that needs answering. And then two other more practical tips I'd give. So I was very much what we call an early career researcher while working on this project. And I gained a lot from using the resources available to me through my university. So that could be, we've at the University of Southampton got a policy team. So you can talk to them, you can take trainings from them on what even is policy and what level of policy should you target and how do you have policy influence. But equally, there are opportunities such as policy internships or fellowships where you can perhaps be embedded in a government institution for a certain amount of time and understand what it looks like from that side. You know, what does policy generation actually look like? So, yeah, a few tips like that, which I still need to take on board as well, some of those.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for all these brilliant tips. That's very helpful. And also thank you so much for taking the time to take part in this podcast series. It's been a fascinating discussion and I've learned so much from it. And I'm sure the listeners will as well. So thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me on this podcast. And I'm really excited to listen to the other podcasts and learn from them. I hope it's been of use.
I hope you enjoyed this discussion as much as I did. To hear more conversations like this, you can subscribe to the CSAP YouTube channel. You can also subscribe to the CSAP newsletter to get updates on a range of topics at the interface of science and policy. All the relevant links will be in the description of this YouTube video.